Well, good evening. I left my book behind last week, so I went online to the floatingzendo.org and was amazed at how many different versions of this are on our website, on our blog. I guess Dan must have done that.
No, it's the link I sent.
Oh.
And it's Clark's translation.
No, there's no Clark translation on it. There's everything else.
Oh, then it's not the one that I did.
There's a Japanese version, a Chinese version, and then four or five different English versions.
The thing with Clark's versions, though, was even the little booklets. I had one, and we had one made, and this one.
They're not the same. And I found one online with very cute illustrations that I actually printed out, very tiny print, but cute little pictures. And it's not the same words.
And it's Clark's also?
They say it is. It's mostly Clark. It's mostly the same.
Yeah, so I meant to compare that Clark translation with the books. I bet you it's different, but I got my curiosity out now, for sure.
Well, it gets very confusing to me. It boggles my mind when I try to find all these different words trying to explain something, and we don't. I'd rather just suspend disbelief and go with one translation and assume that it knows what it's talking about, unless it's radically strange. But none of these is radically strange. It's all pretty much the same. This version of Clark bunches it all together, so it just is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 paragraphs rather than a whole book full of stanzas. And that makes it in some ways a little more difficult to make out.
Do you want a copy of the
Well, Musong has the Clark one. It's hard to find. That's why I was looking for another one. But it's right here in the very beginning. Translated by Richard Clark. And it's not. It's just run all together in a piece. It's not stanzas, the way I learned it. It was stanzas. Yes. Which is a little easier, I think, but so I talked about the first four sentences, or the first four lines, first two sentences last week. And maybe we should go on and do the next few, which in this translation goes, make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. So I think that's enough, that little bit. Do we wish to see the truth? We say we do, but I suspect, looking at my own mind and the way I live my life, that it's very easy not to want to see the truth, not to want to know too much about what's going on. A lot of the truth is very painful. And I started out life as a kind of Pollyanna, and I can find that in myself a lot. Oh, things are fine. Everything's going along just fine. And then I find that, with shock, that it's not that way. But often the shock is a kind of wake-up. I suspect we all have to do that in a way. We or at least feel we're protecting ourselves from too much disturbance. But the kind of peace he's talking about here is not that kind of peace. The kind of peace that is not seeing what's out there too carefully so that we can create a sort of cloudy, beautiful world for ourselves. Truth is, the world isn't so very beautiful in a lot of ways. And to ignore the dark side is creating not only confusion, but worse. Setting up what you like against what you dislike is a disease of the mind. And that's what that is, just not agreeing to what doesn't fit our picture. Or our wishes and hopes. And our best often and when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. But this brings up a lot of questions about how to be if we take this point, this way. It takes some real attention to figure out how to be in a situation like Auschwitz in the early 1940s, or in Darfur right now. What kind of mind do we bring to our situations? I was listening to someone talking about Farmer. Dr. Farmer has been in Haiti for many years, and he was talking about the situation and saying there were a lot of very excited people wanting to help, and they weren't very helpful because they were so excited and weren't talking to each other, and ran in and did a few things and then went away again. And he said it takes some careful attention to what the situation really is if you want to be helpful. And that attention doesn't have a lot of emotion in it, or a lot of the kind sort of grandiose emotion that people sometimes bring to a situation like that. Oh, I'm going to help. What can I do? He said what's really needed is people who are willing to commit for a long time, to really be there, and suffer with everyone. And that's a very different picture from what our culture even tells us. We need to cultivate our happiness and then share our happiness with everyone. But happiness doesn't really work like that. Our happiness comes, real happiness comes when we've forgotten ourselves entirely. Because we're with everyone. We're totally engaged. Dogen talks about dropping off body and mind. Just being where and who we are, just vividly alive, doing what we do, is the source of our happiness. It's not some fancy thing. And is the peace that Sengsong is talking about. The mind's essential peace is disturbed. We were born in peace. So for holding opinions for or against anything is figuring out what is good, what is bad, or what we like, what we don't like. And that's a very good place to put ourselves, to study ourselves, to see how we actually work around those things. How we choose what we choose and on what basis. I just read somewhere a Tibetan said, please remember that this place is the best place and this moment is the best moment. And this material has a great deal to do not only with wisdom but with time. Time and space, actually. The way is perfect like vast space, is the next sentence, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. The way, the Buddha way. As I said before, he used the word Tao because that's the Chinese word that they had for the big something, and it was taken over to and applied to the Buddha way, or even the mind of Buddha. So the way is perfect like vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. The Avatamsaka Sutra says we let ourselves be pierced by everything, by all things. But then it's important to know what that ourself is. It would be very easy to, well, it wouldn't be so easy, but we could work hard to drop all our barriers and become a waif, a lost soul. It isn't that kind of dropping off. It's the other kind. It's the empowerment side. To be the queen or the king in the realm, which indeed we are. Tibetans talk about that some. We feel pounded by things, but as the Heart Sutra said, the things is just us. In one of the translations, it says, be serene in the oneness of things. Oh, here it is, down here. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. Of course, all of this is based on meditation. It's how we learn to sit. By sitting. The sitting itself teaches us. And then with sitting, we find the mind of it and can cultivate that mind. And what is sometimes called Buddha eye. The eye that's able to see not only each distinct thing and experience it, be pierced by it, but also see the whole. I often think the best illustration I ever saw was when my father-in-law took us up into the high mountains of Los Angeles behind L.A., where you could look far down to the city and see the freeways way down there, all the lights, the white lights going in a stream and the red lights going the other way in a stream. And Papa said, nothing's happening. Nobody's banging into each other. It's all going along just the way, and it's going night and day like that. Every now and then there's a little blip. But basically, the whole thing is functioning without some big boss telling it where to go. Each little car is going its own way. And yet it's all going. Sometimes we talk about that eye as the eye of wisdom and the one that's involved with every distinct thing is the eye of compassion. With compassion, we're strong enough, ennobled enough to be able to meet. And we're strong enough and wise enough to know how much we can do. So that in a strange way, we're working our way through moment by moment and place by place, both ways. And when we forget in the midst of the details, often something happens that reminds us, oh, there's a bigger picture. That's why Thich Nhat Hanh invented that little bell. So even when he was talking, he would stop and ring the bell and everybody would be quiet. Oh, we're here. Huh. Fancy that. So I think we need to all develop a little bell of some kind. a stone in our pocket or some kind of reminder. Ah, oh, there's a big picture too. There questions? Allie?
Starting a little bit with the question of discrimination and making good judgments, and how is that different from picking and choosing and having preferences that we want to kind of step back from and see a bigger picture.
I think he's talking about being attached to our judgments. We have to make judgment. Just across the street, we have to make a decision, and it should be better be a good one. But it's when we become create distinctions between myself and everything else, and then aggrandize this side and not realize what the other side is. It's more about the self-other distinction than it is about good and bad particularly.
And judgments that we need to make just to kind of live our lives and
protect ourselves. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
Also in this book too, because I've often been confused too, you know. Don't discriminate. There is evil and there is good.
Yes. Yes.
He says it here also, he said like a word of caution. This is it. Mm-hmm. He says, and what really clicked for me is what you just said, you know, whether it's based on our own self importance, but remembering precepts, you know, that we have, do have our ethics or sila. Sila, S-I-L-A, the snakes.
Sila.
So it's like, oh yeah, that's how that ties in, you know, sometimes. Because I always remember, you know, one of the first things that I really remember when I began sitting in here with y'all, it's like, it's not the compassion or not having judgment isn't allowing ourselves to be hit by a baseball bat. I think you use right. The example you use. Don't. So I think when I read these lines in this book, I really am enjoying it quite a bit. It's like when we study the Samyukta too, it's like it reiterates itself over and over again, just in different words. It just, and that's what's so interesting about the translations too. It's just somebody else trying to make the same or similar point using the different words. But I just think, how much I thought all my suffering for years and was around this whole concept of self-esteem, not having good self-esteem, not enough self-esteem, self-confidence, and it seemed like the therapy and the workshops I did and the elders all told me I got to build up the self, And I remember being so confident as a teenager and young adult with all my opinions, But I just kind of reflect on it. It's almost no way. Well, what was all that about?
It's a process.
I feel like I spent the first few decades building myself up and the last part of my life tearing myself down.
I think it's necessary. You have this.
It's just interesting, and also, I kind of feel it's not the conflict or Well, yeah, it feels a little bit of a conflict too, as a coach, workshop leader myself. It's like, okay, now, what are your values? What do you like? What do you live for? What's important to you? Oh, let it all go. I just find it so.
It's the way it works.
So I find this poem very, and his commentary is really.
It's excellent. Yeah.
It's, if you don't, yeah.
Thank you. Edith.
When you read the lines, maybe think how many opinions and judgments constantly flood our minds every day about people and situations. And it would be so nice that we could just, cut it like men's use your sword.
Yeah.
But once you're in it, you can't. And I remember hearing that right view is having no view.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if there are any other ways that you think we might work with that.
I think developing appreciation, which means really studying what's before us rather than quickly making a snap judgment, assuming that we don't know what's before us and that there's something to know that we can appreciate. I think that's the thing that confuses us, is we think we have to do it, and we don't. We can be extremely curious instead. But it feels a little risky because a lot of all of that is to protect ourselves and not engage, not get involved. Even in our mind, we don't want to get involved because we might have to take on someone else's suffering. And the bottom line of this is that we are other people's suffering, and they ours. So the careful ways that we can be with others, truly be with others, takes a kind of curiosity and appreciation. Even the dirty old guy sitting on the sidewalk with a bottle and a bag is somebody, and probably somebody really interesting. No, and anything else like that. Wendy?
Yeah, I have an experience like that yesterday, seeing a young person panhandling on the freeway, and his legs were about half the length of ours. It was very curious, and he didn't have a wheelchair, and all he had was a skateboard there. It was a very haunting image, and I was in my car, and I always these haunting images in my car, and it touches you, and you don't respond because you're in your car. You don't have. But you don't feel like you have anything to give them. It really affects me to think what could I have done?
Yeah.
Just appreciate my own legs.
Well, that for sure.
Anyway.
and just caring is a big step also. We try not to care because it's difficult. But if you're willing to care, that means you're willing to live your life for others as well as yourself. And that changes every aspect. Your whole world changes then. It becomes lighter in one way and heavier in another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's 8. So, to be continued.